If it's Thursday, 6 p.m., that means it's time for Perspectives by John Pierce. Welcome to Perspectives by John Pierce on this Thursday evening. Our topic this evening, well, let's get into it this way. In 2001, the unthinkable happened when Bethlehem Steel declared bankruptcy after nearly a century and a half of making iron and steel for bridges, buildings, dams, railroad rails, ships, armor plating, armaments, and numerous other products. When the flagship plant in Bethlehem closed, it sat abandoned for some years before the hallowed site was largely repurposed with what we see today as a casino, hotel, restaurant, shopping, and an entertainment complex. Well, we're going back now in history with two gentlemen who have become big fans of talking about the history of Bethlehem Steel. They are, I wanted to say, the Landis brothers. That's not quite right, is it, John?
No, it's more of a father-son team.
Yes, it is, a father-son team. And they have written a book called Bethlehem Steel, Rusting Relic. And James, that sounds like a description of me. I wonder if someday if I write my memoir, I might call it John Pierce, Rusting Relic. I love that. John Landis, a steel plant tour guide with historic Bethlehem museums and sites, is often asked if he worked for Bethlehem Steel. And what's the answer to that, John?
The answer is no. I'm an imposter when I do my tours, but I feel like I have worked for the steel oftentimes.
But the reason that we're having this interview now is I went on a tour with you. You gave me a personal tour because it was in January, a little cool out there, a little icy, and I was the one who showed up. And you gave me an hour and a half tour. And it was so fascinating. So John is a graphic designer and professor emeritus of art. That's Kutztown University. But on tour days, he feels as if he does work for this icon of American heavy industry, albeit as a looper. John, what's a looper?
A looper is actually a newly hired middle management person who gets shown around the plant. And our plant was 4.5 miles long at one point. And so it's a long distance from one end to the other. And they wear a big cross shape in red on their hats so that other people know that they don't know all the safety rules. They're just learning about the plant. The name came from how much Bethlehem Steel top executives love to play golf. And they always referred to playing a round of golf or 18 holes as a loop of golf.
Oh.
We think it might be a Scottish expression. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I don't know that.
Yeah.
A looper.
Yes.
Okay. And then this is John Landis, who just spoke, and his son, Stephen Landis, works as a key account manager in the automotive industry, where he has been employed in a variety of roles for nearly two decades. He is an inventor and creative writer, enjoys the agony and elation of mountain climbing, and loves photographing the beautiful, bizarre, and especially hard-to-access or abandoned places. And Steve, you did that in spades with the Rusting Relic, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
With your photography. What were the years that you took all those beautiful pictures that are in the book?
So most of the photos are from 2006. I had a chance to tour the plant twice in 2006. I've been back a couple times since, but never with so-called open access the way I did back then.
Right. And you took pictures of parts of the former Bethlehem Steel plant that we would never see again. The person who just goes to take a look doesn't have access.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, a lot of the buildings are either you know, gone, or they're fenced off, and you know, you're not allowed to access them anymore. And a lot of things have changed there. And so 2006 was, you know, an amazing opportunity to just explore, and it'll never be like that again, unfortunately. So,
right. Yeah. I drive past the steel stacks every time I come to WDIY, and I will think of the two of you now as I do that, because here we are with this beautiful book, Bethlehem Steel, Rusting Relic, which, by the way, was published in 2003.
The book was published in 2023. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yep.
2023.
Yeah, it took a while. Yeah.
Yes. So, right. Yeah. Right. I think, John, I was thinking about your retirement from Kutztown University and
right.
mine from Muhlenberg College when I said 2003.
That's right.
So 2023 is correct for the book.
Correct.
So what was the impetus for the book? Did it come from Steve or did it come from John?
Came from Steve, I can unequivocally say, and tell more about that, Steve.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a team effort here, but you know, my dad in 2019 started doing tours at Bethlehem Steel, and so at that point, the you know, doing tours, I guess, once a week or maybe twice a week at most. You know, he approached me. I was living in Seattle at the time for work, and he said, Steve, I know, you know, it's been a while, 15 years, give or take, and you took photos of Bethlehem Steel. I would love to use those photos during my tours. And so I sent him, you know, a couple DVDs that I had, DVD-Rs that I had burned, and he went through the photos. And, you know, back in 2006 when I took the photos, I didn't really have a chance to do much with them. I was looking for a way to publish them, get them, you know, maybe in an art gallery, whatever, and that kind of stalled out, and you know, life went on. But then, when he asked me in 2019 for the photos, I sent them to him, and I kind of, you know, blew the dust off and started looking at the photos again myself, and that was sort of the beginning of this book.
So, yes, yeah. And it's a 96 page book. The text. Most of it is written by John, correct? And the photos by Steve.
Right, and so, Steve wrote all the captions for the photos.
Right. And they are beautiful color pictures, too. I think they're all in color, aren't they, Steve?
They are. Yeah.
And so, John, let's see. Question, since we're talking about the book, who publishes your book? Where is it sold?
I'll let Steve answer that.
So Font Hill Media actually is the publisher. They're based out of London. And then they originally distributed the book through America Through Time. Now that, I believe, is actually Casemate. But Font Hill is still the publisher.
Right. So. Good. And where, if people want to get hold of this book, which I highly recommend, if they're interested in the story of Bethlehem Steel, where would they go?
So a couple places locally, Schwab Shop, which I guess is actually a historic museum and sites location here in Bethlehem. So that's Schwab Dry Goods Shop, I guess is the full name. National Museum of Industrial History, also in Bethlehem. There is Firefly Bookstore in Kutztown, and then online Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Ron's Books, etc.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. John, since I met you on this great tour that you give of the steel, we call it the steel, don't we?
Indeed we do.
How frequently do you conduct these? Tell me about how you got into this whole thing.
I personally conduct the tours usually just once a week, sometimes twice, as Steve mentioned. But we do have the tours offered by Historic Bethlehem Museums and Sites Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday each week at 1 p.m. and the tour lasts about an hour and a half.
Right. So those 4 days of the week, I've forgotten which day I went in that I found that I could. You were there ready to give the tour, and I showed up, and so I got a personal tour. Man, that was terrific. And it costs $20, and it is money well spent for anyone who is really interested in one of the iconic companies of our whole country, Bethlehem Steel. How about the origins of Bethlehem Steel, John? Let's go way back.
Okay, the real origins, I've got to say, I will attribute to the Moravians, a religious group from what's part of Czech Republic today. And when they were deeded 500 acres of land along the Lehigh River back in 1741, which was really the start of the city of Bethlehem, they were very industrious people. And they floated logs down the Lehigh River and hollowed them out to make what we believe was the first water pumping system in the colonies. But they also worked a lot with metal, and here's why I give them the origins of our company, in a sense. They made cooking utensils out of copper and zinc. They made horseshoes, hinges, and farm implements out of iron. And then we, on an industrial scale, made iron and steel on our property for nearly 150 years. The origins of the company itself being a corporate entity had 1857 as the start of that, and it was Saucony Iron Company back in those days, but it took till the 1860s when an industrious person named Robert Sayer laid out the design and supervised construction of Bethlehem Iron Company. He was the vice president of Lehigh Valley Railroad, and he had his financing for the railroad by Asa Packer, a well-known name in this area as the founder of Lehigh University. Asa Packer himself was a canal boat owner, but yet he realized that the future of industry in the United States was going to be not canals, but the railroads. And so he really was the one who originated the early days of the company. But then Charles M. Schwab, different middle initial from the investor, Charles M. Schwab, was a very aggressive investor who bought up a number of smaller iron companies and consolidated them into what would become Bethlehem Steel. And this was around the turn of the last century, around the early 1900s.
Are these two Schwabs related or no?
Best of my knowledge, not. Very often I'm asked that by people on my tours, but the middle initial says it all. It's a different Schwab.
Yeah, different. Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's part of the you're going way back to the middle of the 19th century.
Correct.
For the beginning of what would become Bethlehem Steel. When did the name Bethlehem Steel come to be?
It was at the beginning of the 19th century when we started to use that name.
Beginning of the 20th century.
20th century, yeah.
Beginning of the 20th century, that's right. I got my centuries mixed up. I have to remember that we're in the 21st century.
Yeah, right now. There we go. Ooh, time moves on.
Right. So, yes. So we used that name. So and up until the 1960s, it was called Bethlehem Steel Company, but then we became Bethlehem Steel Corporation.
Okay. So I don't know what difference that makes, do you?
I don't know either, but I have I'll call it a souvenir. I have what the workers called a brass check, which is a little medallion that they would carry in their pocket that was the equivalent of today's magnetic key card that showed that you were allowed to be on the property. Steel mills always had very tight security, and you had to show this brass check as you came in the plant entrance.
Now, by check, what do you mean?
It was a little coin, basically.
A coin?
A coin, yes, it was, and it was made of brass. And on the one side, it clearly says Bethlehem Steel Company, and I had a person on my tour one time say to me, that means this was from prior to 1960. Because it would have said Bethlehem Steel Corporation had it been after 1960.
Interesting.
So I believed him, and I guess that's correct. Now, I must admit my artifacts such as that I have bought online in one form or another from usually eBay. And I don't know. I do not know the origins of it really, but yeah.
This is our topic this evening on perspectives, Bethlehem Steel, its history and its flourishing and also, unfortunately, its demise. Talking with my guests, Stephen and John Landis, who have written a beautiful book about the history of the steel. Time for us to take a break. So, dear listeners, hang in there. We'll be back in just a moment on WDIY Allentown.
Unlimited possibilities, folk music from across the Atlantic to the Lehigh Valley. Songs from this country's roots to the songs of today.
Oh, baby, I'm getting ready. I'm getting ready to let you go.
The Carter Family to Joan Baez, Patty Griffin to John Gorka. There's always a great variety on Unlimited Possibilities. Friday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY Allentown.
Bethlehem Steel. Yes, one of the iconic companies of our country. Here we are right in the heart of where Bethlehem Steel used to be, at least the flagship company. John, there were other companies also. There were other places, I should say, besides Bethlehem.
Yes, we had 10 plants in 6 states. Nearby ones that may sound familiar to your listeners, Sparrows Point, Maryland, we had a major plant, Johnstown, Pennsylvania, Lackawanna, New York, and Burns Harbor, Indiana, among the 10 additional plants. But, of course, Bethlehem is the flagship plant, and the company is named for the city, of course.
And the two big, huge steel companies were Bethlehem Steel and?
U.S. Steel.
Right.
And they were always number one in profits and production. But I always add when I say that we made an excellent product that was consistently high quality, but we were always number two.
All right. When you said there was a Bethlehem Steel plant in Johnstown, that sounds like U.S. Steel territory to me. Mm-hmm. Are you getting close there? Huh?
Getting close to our competition.
Yeah.
But we did have a Bethlehem plant there.
So, John, tell us a little bit more about the tours that you give. Now, again, what are the days and time?
Okay, it's 1 p.m. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. Tour lasts about an hour and a half, and it is an outdoor tour. So if you were to come on my tour, dress appropriately. We walk along a walkway that parallels what we call the Hoover Mason Trestle. When we started to become an industrial power, we had to store our raw materials in what we called the ore yards, which was about 2,000 feet, almost a half a mile away from our blast furnaces. And so we needed a way to bring the raw materials to the blast furnaces. And so we commissioned two architects from Chicago named Frank Hoover and Arthur Mason to come up with an idea. And what they came up with was a 46-foot-high railroad trestle that would go between the ore yards and the blast furnaces to bring taconite, coke, and limestone to the furnaces. And we walk along a walkway that's built by the same people that built the High Line in New York. It's like a long, narrow garden, and that parallels the trestle, and that's as close as you can get to the furnaces.
When I talked to my wife about this interview that we have right now, she asked, why did the company decide to establish itself in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania? And then I think about these three ingredients that you just mentioned. What are they again?
The three ingredients are, the most important is the taconite, which is a low-grade iron ore. And there were taconite mines close. In fact, even when we were doing this on an industrial scale, our three mines that were the closest, taconite quarries, were not far from the plant. And the limestone and the originally charcoal as the fuel source, but also coal that ultimately got made into coke, were nearby. So everything was close in the early days and just got brought in by horse cart, basically, just over the hill. As time went on, we had to get things from farther away. We got taconite, the low-grade iron ore, from as far away as Central and South America, Mesabi Iron Range, northern Minnesota, southern Ontario province in Canada, Labrador, and even Liberia in North Africa.
Oh. And the plant was established on a river.
Yes.
Which was important?
Absolutely. We needed river water, and the city really got established where the Monocacy Creek flows into the Lehigh River. And very often, towns and cities, whether they were going to become industrial towns and cities or not, they looked for a water source.
Absolutely.
Yep.
So let's go to Steve with a question. You were exploring the plant and climbing up blast furnaces, and particularly, you mentioned here blast furnace D. So tell us about the letters here on the blast furnaces.
Okay, yeah. So still standing, obviously silenced, but still standing, we have blast furnaces A through E. There was, some time ago, an F and a G, but they're gone. They had an explosion, and so there's just, basically there was open land there for some years, and now I guess it's a parking lot, right? And so for the casino and the hotel. But we still have A through E. B and D are the two highest blast furnaces. They're roughly 250 feet high. I did have the incredible experience, being able to climb up blast furnace D back in 2006, and some of my photography in the book is from that, different perspectives as I was going up the blast furnace. But yeah, really a amazing vantage point, and a little bit wild experience with the derelict ladders, and a little bit of free soloing that we term in rock climbing when you're climbing. Basically a structure without a rope, and it was an amazing experience.
Yeah, you're holding on to an expensive camera all the while.
Yeah, and not even my camera, borrowed camera, but that I had to return.
Have to ask you, Steve, was it a borrowed cell phone?
No, it was not. It was a digital camera, Olympus, good camera, but not a cell phone, no.
You're a good man for not being absolutely, what's the word I'm looking for here, John?
Consumed by cell phone photography?
Yes,
yeah.
or being...
Reliant upon, yeah.
Yeah.
Can't think of it now.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few photos I have to admit, more recently that I did take with a cell phone, maybe two or three photos that show up in the book, but almost everything is from that Olympus digital camera. And one thing that I do get asked a couple times, I guess every time we do a book talk, people end up saying, did you use a drone for the photography? And I say, no, I climbed the structures. It's a very common question, actually. People expect, that's a drone photograph, but it's not.
Right. And the photos are gorgeous. So those of you who are listening who like picture books, this is a picture book. And the title of it is Bethlehem Steel Rusting Relic. And the authors are Stephen M. Landis and John K. Landis, father and son. Not necessarily in that order. This will confuse everybody,
right.
John. So, John, how did Bethlehem Steel influence our country and global history, would you say?
Well, I would say the most profound influence was what we did during the two world wars. We directly affected world history in the warships that we built for both world wars. Just before the First World War, the Navy made a concerted effort to rebuild all their ships, not with iron or any other materials, but with steel. And so we supplied the steel prior to the First World War. But then we were a major supplier during the war of armor plate and ordnance. Ordnance is really the weapons, the ammunition, the military supplies. And then prior to the Second World War, before U.S. got into the war, after it had started in 1939 in Europe, we had what I like to call a call to arms from President Franklin Roosevelt to Eugene Grace, our president. He said, the war's not going well. This was early part of our involvement in the war after Pearl Harbor. He said, we're losing a lot of shipping in the North Atlantic to German U-boats. We're increasingly going to have the war in the Pacific. I need from Bethlehem Steel a ship a day.
Oh.
And Bethlehem Steel answered the call and built 1,121 ships and 15 extras if you want to count a ship a day. And we built the components in number 2 machine shop, which is a long building. I believe it's a third of a mile long, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Yep.
Yes. And it still stands on our property. Unfortunately, you can't go in it. Not much to see in it. It's rather vacant. But in that building, we built the components for 1,121 ships. And we sent the components almost like a kit, if you will, to either Brooklyn Navy Yard, where our shipbuilding division assembled the ship and floated on the open ocean, or to Sparrows Point, south of Baltimore, where our shipbuilding division there assembled the ship and floated on the Chesapeake Bay.
Wow. So that's well, two world wars, huh?
Yes, really two world wars. The most profound influence, I would say, was the Second World War. It's been said that the Allied cause would not have won the war had it not been for what went on in number 2 machine shop. And we actually had 30,000 people working on our property here in Bethlehem alone, 10,000 coming and going each shift during the Second World War.
Right. And when you're talking about each shift, you're talking about 24 hours a day.
Correct. 3 shifts, round the clock. Yep.
Wow.
In peacetime, we had 20,000 working on our property, so 30,000 was still a significant number.
So what would you say would be the decades of the height of the glory of Bethlehem Steel?
I would say for sure the Second World War and then the post-war era, when there was a great pent-up demand among consumers for products they couldn't get during the war. Automobiles, washers, dryers, refrigerators, and they were the best of times for Bethlehem Steel.
Right. They could be the best of times for our country.
In a sense, they were. You're right.
Because I grew up being born during the Second World War.
Me too.
You too. With just taking for granted all these things. Well, of course we have a washer, dryer, 2 cars for the family, and so on.
You know, right.
And an ability to have a house of your own. All these things that came along after the Second World War, basically.
That's right. And steel was a major factor in consumer goods of that
right.
Era.
Now, we've been tossing around the term steel because it is Bethlehem Steel that we're talking about. But iron has something to do with this. What's the difference between iron and steel?
The way we made steel during most of our existence was we made iron first in the blast furnaces. We made the taconite, which was the iron ore, melt, the word smelt, it's really the word melt with an S in front of it, and that made molten pig iron. And the pig iron got tapped from the blast furnaces and processed. Since the Second World War, we processed the iron using what we called the basic oxygen process, or the BOF, the basic oxygen furnace, where we blew pure oxygen through the iron, converted it to steel that way. Prior to that, it had been the Bessemer process and the open hearth process, which everyone seems to know those terms. They're for the purpose of removing impurities from the iron, and that's what converts iron into steel. And steel is 4 to 6 times stronger than iron, and steel is not instable in extreme hot or cold weather, and it's not brittle the way iron is.
Iron is brittle.
Iron is brittle compared to steel. Steel is very flexible.
Wow.
Yep.
All right. I'll think about that, John, the next time I run into an iron fence of some sort.
Right.
Hey, you're supposed to be brittle.
Yeah.
Is any part of Bethlehem Steel still in business, Steve?
Yes. One of the key things that we still have is Lehigh Heavy Forge. And so they have remained operational since the late 19th century. They actually began as a division of Bethlehem Steel, specifically for military contracts, mostly naval contracts. And so they still have some of the original buildings intact, and so they're fully operational. Another company that I more recently learned about is Wire Rope Works, which was actually also a division of Bethlehem Steel. I believe they bought them somewhere around 1937, and so they're still operational. They do wire and cable mostly for bridges. So yeah, that they're still around. And then I didn't have a chance to tell my dad, but I was doing some more research and I saw that at least bits and pieces of the shipbuilding divisions survive via mergers and acquisitions. So there are some pieces of Bethlehem Steel that are still in existence, but not named Bethlehem Steel anymore. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Believe it or not, our time is up, guys. This is John Landis and his son, Stephen Landis, and they have written a book and with gorgeous photography called Bethlehem Steel Rusting Relic. It's something that we all need to have if we're that interested in this huge company called Bethlehem Steel. I'd love to have you back and talk more about this at some point.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yes, thank you so much.
Indeed. It's a topic we love to talk about.
It's fun. We're having fun here.
Yeah, we are.
So let's bring in Billy Joel again, because, and then next time we come together, we're going to tell you all why we're doing Billy Joel's song this time. I'm John Pierce. This is Perspectives. Thanks so much for tuning in. And until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor. Stay tuned now for Charla Comunitaria.